stop talking, I guess.
I think that is what working 10 years at HERA does for you, that I'm asked to talk on forward physics. In fact, 6 years ago, when there was the school here, I think, not in this beautiful auditorium, but in some of the more antique museum-like auditoriums in a neighboring building, I did talk about this, and while they asked me to talk again, I said, sure, I can use the same slides. But as it happens, so much happened in these years on forward physics, from something which was just like ideas we wanted to have to perform that at the experiments, which were not at all foreseen, actually, to do this kind of physics, to the realities we are having now that I could maybe use 3 or 4 of my 100 slides still at the end, and then that was more or less it. And the one I could use is sort of the content, more or less, because I will still go through giving you an introduction on forward physics. And then I will talk about the forward regions in the present LHC experiments. That's actually new. When I talked about it last time, then it was sort of like what we would like to have and what we could have, and now it's actually what we're gonna have, plus a few other plans which are following. As for the physics topics, I'll still go, since this is a school, through a sort of what the didactical approach from what forward physics is, coming from what it was and what we have been discussing so far, for example, at other colliders, and that I would call the classical forward physics program, which will be part of the forward physics program at the LHC. But then, particularly tomorrow, I will go into what I would call the new forward physics, which is particularly interpreting these kind of events and effects in imperturbative QCD. It's going to be a strong interaction type of talk that I will be giving. With recent data from HERA, the Tevatron, and the projections for the LHC, what we want to do there, what we can think we can learn. And one of the interesting sort of windows that has opened in the last 5 years or so is the maturity of getting to understand the production of the Higgs in this kind of mechanism, which is sometimes called a real new way of looking, of measuring the Higgs and measuring its quantum numbers, and I'll spend a lot of time on that, as well as how we would want to do that experimentally. Presently, the experiments at the LHC are actually not able to deal with that right now, but they need some kind of an upgrade, which I will talk about. Plus, there are some topics which are connecting also with other lectures. For example, with the lecture of Keith Ellis, there will be particularly measurements possible here to test low X dynamics, or BFKL, which he probably has mentioned, so testing QCD in a new regime. There are connections with cosmic ray experiments, and there are connections with so-called two-photon interactions, when instead of the hadronic interactions which you're used to think of at the LHC. Okay, so what is it all about? Now, naively, if you look at where is the energy going in an event at the LHC, for example, or at any Hadron Collider, then you see that while the particle density is quite heavy in the central region, the energy flow, as it is given here, goes mostly down to what is called small pseudorapidities. And I hope that everybody is familiar with the pseudorapidity variable, which is just the minus of the logarithm of the tangent of the polar angle divided by 2. That is just, you know, the, if you go at straight down the beam pipe, then you get in these type of pseudorapidities here. So there's where your energy is going. So if you look at something for a half perturbative scatter, usually you want to look in the central region because you get large transverse momentum out of that. These detectors should be excellent in measuring that. If you have something to do which has on top of that, or maybe just only something to do with very large energies, TeV type of energies, then these detectors will actually miss that in their proper, in their present configuration, because all that sort of energy goes forward, goes down the beam pipe. So, topics which you have in there, which you may have heard of, and just for the connection, I will give a more complete list later, are diffractive phenomena, so diffractive scattering, and the old events which have to do with that. Obviously, I'll discuss that quite a bit. Low X phenomena, because low X usually means very asymmetric collisions in the part in the hadronic system, so that typically they are boosted into very forward directions. There could be exotics, like so-called Centauros or tesseract chiral condensates, for those who remember what that may be or have heard of that, which you will find typically in these forward regions, high energy regions. Cosmic rays, very high energetic cosmic rays, which are very popular now, also thinking of the Auger experiment and others, there is a clear link with that, because they are based on our understanding of how this energy gets distributed over particles in these forward ranges. And so we may help them in reinterpreting their data better. And there may be just surprises around, so what, because we don't know what just goes down the beam pipe there. And also, and not least, this is what I mentioned before, such forward tagging, a tagging of this forward activity or non-activity in that matter, may help as a filter for example, centrally produced particles which we want to study, such as the Higgs. And that will be mainly the topic of the second lecture. So this is basically the same in sort of pictures. This is the, if we get into numbers, from the total cross-section, from everything which we see happening in the collisions, 25% of that or so is of the kind of the elastic and diffractive nature. Elastic being just that two protons, they scatter, they exchange some vacuum numbers of, some quantum numbers of the vacuum, and they go out under some small angles as two protons again, nothing breaks up there. That's the elastic collision that is, you know, studied since the dawn of accelerators. Diffraction can come in several incarnations. Here are two diagrams shown. One is where, which looks almost like the elastic one, except that on one side this proton breaks up. This is a dissociation, as they call it, proton dissociation. And we typically call that single diffractive dissociation as one of the processes. But again, you have the same guy running here in exchange with this funny P word, which we will come back later. And then you can have that on both sides, you can have other configurations and so on. There is low X phenomena, as I will come back to, the cosmic rays, as I mentioned, and two photon collisions. For example, when protons interact, apart from their sort of colored constituents which can scatter here, they can in fact emit photons, both of them or just one of them. You can get photon collisions, or you get photon-proton type of collisions. And this is this Higgs diagram, which you can have, centrally produced Higgs. It's been calculated, and there is some experimental evidence that this diagram or this process may happen, as I will show in the second lecture particularly, that you could have a Higgs actually being produced such that the only three particles you produce in the whole interaction, this is at, say, 14 or 10 TeV, whatever you want, the energy probably close to 14 when we're doing this experiment, you produce Higgs singly here, and you keep the protons down there. And the fun of that is, if you tag these protons, in fact, by calculating the missing mass towards these two protons with respect to the beam, you can determine a peak even in that distribution to see where the Higgs is. We will come for that. In that sense, this process as it's gone here, recently hit some news, 19th of June or something. It says it's a Higgs boson without a mass. Some read it Higgs boson without a mass and said, how can this be? No, it's a Higgs boson without a mass. The mass being that if you do it inclusively, there is so much stuff around here that it's sometimes very difficult to actually see the Higgs. And for example, there are some decay channels where the Higgs goes into 2Bs, which would be a very important decay channels because it can teach us quite a bit on how, for example, the Higgs couples to the high mass flavors. becomes invisible at the LHE, or it's hidden under the background. Now, with this kind of process, that's of that clean nature that you can actually see that. And that actually was produced, this article, in the context of some control measurements which have been done at the Tevatron, obviously not looking at the Higgs here, because they wouldn't have the capability, they don't have enough energy or luminosity to do so. But you can have another object here, like, for example, a Chi-C type of particle with a lower mass and much higher cross-section, which they can measure. And by comparing that measurement from that other particle with theory, they realize that the theory actually predicts correctly that this process is at work. So there is good hope that indeed that Higgs process is around too. Hence, we may be going out to find it. Okay, but that's for tomorrow. For today, I will discuss sort of like what I said, the classical forward physics, or the classical forward physics approach, starting with as early as John started, maybe a little earlier than he did. This is in the 1960s when QCD wasn't around there, and people tried to understand how hard how strong interactions worked. Then sort of the emerging phenomenology of the time that actually seemed to work well was called Regge theory, and probably I don't know how many of you have heard of Regge theory or had to deal with it. In fact, I myself, by the time I got into the game, this was no longer fashionable because that was already been taken over by QCD. But there are still regions in our scattering, particularly in sort of in a few body type of scattering, where the Regge phenomenology works well, even up to the highest energies which we are having. And that was basically a mathematical construct using so-called scattering amplitudes. I warn you before, we're not going to need this anywhere in the lecture, then, so don't get scared if this looks all weird to you. But it's just to give it in the context of what things are happening. And particularly with the elastic scattering, there are some consequences which are important. Therefore, I want to point them out. So, there is some scattering amplitudes which has certain properties like analyticity, unitarity, and a certain crossing symmetry. Crossing symmetry meaning that you can exchange S-channel processes by its T-channel components. So the pipe proton collision in this channel, you can actually revert and take a T-channel there, and for example, get to the pi minus pi zero correlated cross-section and so forth. So it has lots of nice things, could make predictions, and they seem to fit well with the data, so that was useful to have. But as said, as soon as QCD came along, this was left behind, and it's still used, I would say, in some regions where, for example, perturbative methods don't work, and where these things are becoming quite actually this is Regge, the father of this thing, and I think he's, as far as I know, he's still alive. And in fact, 10 years ago, he went into the European Parliament as a member of the Communistic Party, or so, of Italy, for those who are interested in that. One of the important features which come out of this Regge theory is the so-called optical theorem. And that relates elastic scattering and the elastic scattering amplitudes to the total cross-section, which is given here, which you can sort of expand, and at the end you come out with a diagram which is looking like that, which goes T equals zero, so there is no momentum transfer here. The momentum transfer between the top and bottom is zero, while here you have something as a function of momentum transfer. And giving here the expression for elastic scattering and the total cross-section, you see that the same amplitudes come there, be it this one at zero. And that can be used in experiments, for example, to simultaneously measure this and get some luminosity-independent measurements of the total cross-section, as we will see. But there are couplings and stuff around, but we won't need that. Okay, now to get the feel for why this is called forward particle, or what means forward particle production here, and how does it evolve if you go from one accelerator to the other, this is, for example, the Tevatron 2 TeV type of beams, 14 TeV at the LHC, and this was the Very Large Hadron Collider once thought of. I didn't hear about it the last 5 years, but it's still on the map here. What would happen in a 100 TeV type of collider machine? This is the pseudo-rapidity, and this is sort of where empirically, the maximum eta is reached for the particles you produce in a collider. There is a tail because, in principle, if the particle has zero PT, it would have go 0 degree, and therefore eta would go to the full end here. But since the particles have PT of the order of the mass of the proton or a bit less, this gives you the fall-off curve of the reach where you have. It tells you where you may want to put detectors. For example, if you want to see a certain rapidity or certain completeness of the event, if you want to measure it fully. So these are the corresponding angles, which correspond to these pseudo-rapidities. So you go quickly of, let's say, you're like a micro-rat or so. This is a very small angle indeed. But you do get there for, say, a particle which has a 500 MeV type of PT, typically of 50 to 100 or so TeV being emitted there at such a big collider. If you want to measure that, say, put a detector, measure these particles outside the beam pipe and give the radius of the beam pipe to be 3 centimeters, then you have to go away clearly forward. Here it's 3 meters, here it's 3 kilometers in order to get that out. So fortunately we are not in that range, but we are in a range of 14 TeV where we may have to go in the hundreds of meters in some cases, as we will see, to get out these forward particles. Okay, now I'm sure you saw that, the LHG, I don't know if anybody told you, but the LHG is actually 7 experiments. And you know certainly the 4 uppermost ones, so CMS Atlas, LHGB Alice. There are 2 smaller ones which are conjunct in using interaction region with the other experiments. One is Totem, and Totem is an experiment actually specially made for measuring forward physics. Particularly, it's going to go for the soft part in the forward physics, measuring the elastic and total cross section and some of the diffractive components in that. I'll explain later. And on the Atlas side, there is an experiment called LHCF, which uses that interaction region, but it doesn't disturb Atlas too much because it's sitting like 150, 147 meters away from Atlas on both sides here. And it will measure particles which go at 0 degrees, neutral ones, pi zeros, which go at 0 degrees, or the photons of the pi zeros. When the beams separate, then they will catch these photons. I will show that experiment tomorrow. There is even a 7th experiment, which I think is at the verge of being approved, at least the TDR is being circulated. It's called MERDAL, which is something very special. If anybody's interested, I can talk about during discussion or something like that. That's to discover monopoles, and that's the only purpose it really has, or very heavy ionizing particles which are coming from the interaction region. It's an ideal experiment if you don't want to do shifts, but I will not say more. Okay. In fact, the ideas of having what is called a full acceptance detector, a detector which for the first time ever in the history of a collider would detect all particles which are being produced, was given as a 5th experiment. It's not on the map, as you saw, because in fact it was put on ice in 97, and it's no longer really discussed, but it was in principle a cute idea. It was called Felix, and it was a detector which was simple centrally, but still a central detector, and went up to the many hundreds of meters, detecting basically all the particles produced out of there, using magnets as sort of spectrometers to filter them out from the beam if they were too close to the beam and detect them. But it did not happen. But the ideas actually stayed around, and I'll tell you about it. So this is for 4 detectors at the LHG, what we have at present. And this is a slide which looks very different than what I would have shown 6 years ago, because there's a lot has happened here of detectors which have been added to the central detectors in order to cover more of this forward region. For example, CMS has calorimeters added to that, and it's also has been discussing and been organizing itself in order to use Totem, which is an experiment that is sitting around CMS using the forward region, to have common runs with Totem and have a maximum of acceptance. And I'll show that. Atlas, meanwhile, has decided to have some detectors which are going to be needed in order to determine the total cross-section, which and therefore can lead us to understand luminosity. And they have been approved. In fact, they are probably being installed as we talk, but they will, I don't know if they will run already in 2010. there is a detector which is also for luminosity, which is sitting very forward, which is a Cherenkov detector, which can be used, in fact, to find particularly gaps in events, which is an important concept in forward physics, as we'll see. Plus, similarly to CMS, there are some very forward calorimeters, which are called 0 degree, and which are literally at 0 degrees. ALICE has also such 0 degree calorimeters. It has a forward muon spectrometer from Nature RSS, and it has now also a diffractive program they're looking into. LHCb has forward muons, and they are planning to study low X Parton distributions. And then there are these two experiments by themselves, TOTEM and LHCf. TOTEM will use some kind of near-beam detector at 200 meters to take out these particles, plus some more central detectors to count events. And the LHCf detector, which has also been approved a few years ago, which is sitting, which is using the interaction region of ATLAS, but not actually sitting there, it's sitting at 140 meters, consists of an electromagnetic calorimeter to see photons and pions going under a very small angle, which are relevant for cosmic ray studies. And then there is an R&D project that happened in the meantime, and which is called FP420 for forward protons at 420 meters, and that particularly targets to tag these protons which have to do with this Higgs, which you could measure in this exclusive way, which I told before. This one, unlike the others, is not yet being approved, but that is right now in the hands of the experiments, and they are discussing about it. The R&D phase is basically finalized, as I was sure. Okay, and there is some complementarity, I will not go into that, into the phase space of the central region, forward region, which the experiments are can reach. So, we know probably this experiment, I believe half of the participants in this school work at least in one of these experiments, and that may be symptomatic for high energy physics in the future, that that half of your audience will be always belonging to that. These collaborations are so big. Now, we know that these experiments typically have tracking within an eta range centrally of 5 units, between plus and minus 2.5, and calorimetry extended up to 5 to 10 units if you want. But the forward physics coverage will need more, and therefore there are all these extensions now being added, and they are given here on the axis of how far they are from the interaction point. And you see you have a few close by, like 10, 15 meters away, going further out to 100 meters to 400 meters where this FP420 detectors could be sitting. And this is for IP5, so for CMS, this is for ATLAS. And what you have here is a tracking type of device, which is actually from TOTEM, a Castor calorimeter, a ZDC, and then TOTEM Roman pots here, and possibly this FP420 detectors coming out there. For ATLAS, we have Lucid sitting here, ZDC, the Alpha Roman pots, maybe some pots for 220 coming up about there, and FP420 there perhaps as well. Just to give you an idea how it looks, this is such a combination now in the forward region from CMS and from TOTEM. So as these two detectors are run by TOTEM, if you want, this HF, which goes up to 5 pseudorapidity, and Castor sitting here, Castor sitting there, will have this ranges as it's given here. So you extend the range from 5 to 6.5 or almost 7 if you include the trackers as it is. And that became a reality. In fact, this is a half of the detector which has been installed. Actually, this one has been installed last year already, just before the run was supposed to start then. Then we would have it only at half of the detector. That run did not happen, and also they found some problems that if they switch on the magnet of CMS, which is 4 Tesla, in fact these detectors started to move, which was a bit unfortunate. And that became because in the table on which this detector was, there was 1% of iron in it, which the manufacturer had not told us, because we would not have wanted any iron in that thing, because the fringe field is enormous here, and because of that 1% of iron, this thing moved. So we could fix that due to the extra time that we got. And this is how it looks now, today, or a couple of days ago. So these detectors are in, they are a reality. This is a 0 degree calorimeter. It's in fact there where it should go. It sits in here, but you don't see it too well. This is a small calorimeter. And this device sits here. Now the interaction point is up here, and the beams are in the same beam pipe when they come along here. And when they come like about 140 meters, so they're being separated, each in their different beam pipe, the outgoing and the incoming one. And in between here, there's a void where this device is being put. There's also some instrumentation being put by the machine itself to control what's going on actually in that region. And well, you can measure as such things which go under 0 degrees. And of course, if you only the ones which are not bent by the magnets, so the neutral ones will really go there. You can measure that. Originally, this was conceived actually as a detector for the heavy iron run. All the experiments, well, there will be some heavy iron running probably end of next year and in future. And for certain measurements, which are called the centrality of such a collision, it's very important to see how much energy you get being spread under 0 degrees. And that was the main motivation for these. This is Totem. And this is the experimental layout and the detector. So Totem is in conjunction with CMS. These things are not to scale. CMS is much, much bigger than what you see here, but this is made by the Totem people. So these are detectors which sort of squeeze in here on the sides. These are these T1 telescopes. These are, they measure charged particles. They typically measure together with the telescopes at T2, which are sitting at 14 meters within that range. So they don't really have a central measurements. They have only something between 3 and 7. And they have Roman pot stations, so these are detectors which are actually meant to come very near to the beam detector, and I'll show actually how that works in a second. And well, that's what it is. They are at 150 and 200 meters. And as said, the thing would be now to measure them, such events together. Such type of near-beam detectors, they're often called Roman pots, except in Bologna. They're called Bologna pots. At least when Zikiki was the boss there, because I made once the error to talk about Roman pots, and he gave me a 10-minute lecture why this is a Bologna pot. Anyway, history aside, I will do what most people do and call them Roman pots. They are detectors which you can put among the beam line here. And what is the idea? The idea is you measure protons which have lost a bit of energy compared to the beam. A percent, a few percent, a fraction of a percent or so. So what will happen with these protons, they will basically follow the beam line joyfully here. But this beam line is full of magnets to steer the beam, to focus and things like that. And of course, these protons which have lost little energy, they will react differently than the beam. And that's the whole idea. So they will actually leave at some point. So these magnets around here will work as a spectrometer, and they will leave, they will divert of the beam, but sometimes only by fractions of millimeters, particularly, or a few millimeters, particularly at the LHC, where you have a very rigid high energy beam. What happens then is, you, if you want to see these, you want to approach the beam as much as you're allowed to by the machine, and then try to catch these protons which are coming out and measure them in a couple of stations or so, and determine by measuring their angle they are making with when they come out of the beam, you can determine their energies. Now this is a system where normally when the accelerator starts, the beam is rather broad and it moves around in the accelerator or in the beam pipe. You don't want to be with your detector in there already when they are still setting up for the beam, because they will just hit your detector and they will just burn a hole in it, and that's it. So that's no fun. So what is happening then is you typically take them out in some kind of a station here. They are sitting outside, they are waiting until the machine tells, okay, stable beam, then you can try to approach the beam. And when it gets too hot, you move them back out again. So it's a bit of a tedious operation here. But it has been done before. It has been done actually at most proton machines which we have nowadays. For example, it has been done at the Tevatron. In fact, it has been done even at the SPP bar S before, but I don't mention that here, but I'll show a slide later. But at the Tevatron, as a sort of like the active rings which we had recently, D0 for RAN 2, which started like in the beginning of the years 2000, they have been adding Roman pots in it, and this is in fact their layout, so at of the order of 30 to 50 meters, they had to put some detectors. CDF had them in, I believe, till 2007. Hera had them in for until its lifetime. So Hera stopped in 2007, but they were in practically from the beginning for Zeus, and they came in very quickly for H1, when diffraction was sort of appreciated to be an interesting topic to study at Hera in the early years. And also Rick had an experiment which called PP2PP, which has stopped, but these detectors are now being moved from that experiment into the star detector. So they will survive and they will be used. So it's an experimental technique which is not new in that sense. It's an experimental technique which is where there is a lot of expertise with it already in the physics program, which is going on since quite a while. Now, for CMS and TOTEM, since they are in this same interaction region, of course, it was a logical step to think of having common or combined data. And then if you look into this is the phi pseudorapidity range, all where you see some color, this is covered. There are sort of short holes in there because they don't overlap quickly. And these are the Roman pots. These are the calorimeter and trackers from the two experiments, and then the central detector from CMS. There would be this gap left here, so it's not a complete closure type of detector. But there are some ideas also now around to get to do that. They are not yet implemented, but in fact, the detectors for that are in principle ready to be implemented. I'm not sure we can still put them in before this run. And this is just a tribute to an old friend of mine who passed away last year, Peter Schlein, who was one of the people who actually foresaw such kind of experiments in the first time. I think it may be the first combining of a central detector with Roman pots that had been done. That was in 88, when he combined, in fact, an existing UA4 experiment, which was just ring pots, say TOTEM, with an existing central detector, which was then UA2, say CMS now, and made common runs with that. And in fact, on the side discovered something which is still a mystery in things. He discovered that in this diffractive exchange, if you look at it perturbatively, then you have a very hard component there which is still not understood. That's still a puzzling result. It's called a super hard component in diffractive exchange, and we'll see more on that later. Okay, as said, we are moving ahead and trying to cover more in rapidity, to see more of the full event as it being produced at the LHC, at these high energies. And this is a proposal of these red guys here. These are scintillators or some other type of stations. We have actually two possible detectors to put there, to put these around the beam pipe at distances between 60 and 140 meters. And that would cover still this space, as we saw that there was still a gap before, just to tag if there were particles. Of course, you can't make very precise measurements with this, but you can use it to see if there was a gap and there were particles, for example, which can be important for a number of studies. It goes so far that also in LHCb, there is at least a proposal. I'm not saying that LHCb is necessarily taking this very seriously at the moment, but there is a proposal around there for doing something similar, for using the LHCb experiment for diffraction and putting some of these detectors also downstream, like starting from 20 meters up to 60 meters or so downstream the LHC beam pipe magnet system for the outgoing particles. So LHC is already by nature a rather forward experiment because, as you know, it is a collider experiment, but it has an opening in a forward direction in order to be able to use detection techniques for particle identification and so, and also because the BB bar cross section, which is prime interest of LHCb, is largest in that region as sort of given here. So it has an acceptance from 2 to 5 already with tracking, with calorimetry, and so it is a bit privileged in that in some of these areas compared to the other experiments. So it's a matter of extending that with such detectors in the forward region. And you can reach high efficiencies for single diffraction, for example, here given as function of the mass of the diffraction, which is one of the items which at very high, well, it's never been measured, of course, at LHC energies, but even at energies like the Tevatron or so, this is still outstanding, what this component would be of this low mass single diffraction. On ATLAS, I showed before where the detectors are sitting, and here are a few pictures of these detectors. These are the alpha detectors, which are going to be used for the absolute luminosity measurements. And in special runs, you will actually use these detectors because I think they can't stand the high rates or don't deal with it too well. But in these special runs, you can in fact also make a number of high cross-section type of measurements related to diffraction, and I'll show that later as well. This is the 0-degree calorimeter being inserted, and the Lucy detector, which is this Cherenkov detector, which is sitting somewhere at 17 meters, which will help to calibrate luminosities or give relative luminosities from run to run. So, with all that, what can we do with that? Well, there is the so-called soft and hard diffractive program, and I'll spend time on that for sure. That starts with measuring total cross-sections and elastic scattering, looking at survival of gaps and why gaps are special. I will tell you, I mean, diffraction is typically related with something that creates a void of particles somewhere, either in the middle of your event or at the end of an event, and that's still a bit, mysterious what the exact dynamics is, how it is happening. I will show a few of the question marks there. The structure of diffraction, so that what hits, what is being emitted, and what is called the diffractive exchange, sometimes also called the Pomeroy, as I will tell later, the structure of that can be probed and can be checked, and for example see how well that is transportable between different processes, and what you can learn, for example, if you look at different probes for that on the flavor content and so forth. There are the double Pomeroy exchange or the double diffractive exchange type of events where you have diffraction of two sides and you have something in the middle, and that is actually, in QCD terms, a gluon factory. It's a basic collision of glue, as we will see. And that can be an interesting laboratory for studies. Maybe you can look for glue balls and things like that. There is this Higgs production, which I mentioned, and there are a lot of exotica, in fact, which can be produced in such an exclusive environment, and they can be studied, as I said, in a very simple environment in that sense, because it's exclusive. And I mentioned low X dynamics, which typically relates to parton saturation questions, to the dynamics of QCD questions, to the proton structure in general, and to also to multi-parton scattering. The fact that if a proton meets a proton and they make a collision, you have the hard scattering which happens, but maybe there are other scatterings between the proton which are happening independent of this hard scattering you have there, and that's what is called this multi-parton scattering. So there are possible new physics phenomena, which I mentioned before, and this connection when measuring forward energies and particle flows, which is of strong interest for interpreting cosmic ray data. And there are still quite a few open questions around which, for example, a detailed knowledge of how particle production actually works in the forward region would help to resolve. The two photon questions I mentioned, there is also in the nucleus, proton nucleus and nucleus-nucleus collisions, and there are QED processes which are important, which can even help perhaps to get the luminosity determination in the experiments to of the order of a percent or so, if we control, for example, these measurements well. Now, many of these studies can actually best done with the low luminosity type of machine, when you have of the average of one or a few collisions per bunch crossing, and not when you have, 20 events per bunch crossing, for reasons that will become evident. Okay, this was the general introduction to forward physics, and now I'm going to go from processes, as I said, to the classical ones, starting with the most classical, the elastic and total cross-sections, up to diffraction, hard diffraction, and then these exclusive processes. While I do like John and I pause for a second, if there are any questions at this point. Mm-hmm. Yes? Mm-hmm. Or the Bologna pots, yes, depends on
you said
your
that,
religion.
We will see, we will find those particles in beam which have lost energy.
Mm-hmm.
How they have lost energy? They have lost by just increasing the radiation?
Yeah, they have lost energy typically because they created something. So something was taken out of the beam. Take, for example, this Higgs process which I had. You have two protons, they meet, and there's Higgs being produced, and then the two protons go on. So the energy which is made to create the mass of the Higgs must come from the energy which the protons had in the original way. So they lost something like a few percent of their energy, in this case it's more like 7% of their energy, in order to make this Higgs. And so they don't have a seven, if you all, let's say, let's rescale it to the numbers of today. And if you have normally 10 TeV collisions, so 5 TeV per beam, they would come out with 4.5 TeV instead of 5 TeV. So they will have less energy. They will move along happily still at the speed of light of almost with all these other protons. But once there is a magnet, you can catch them, because the magnet bends the 5 TeV on a certain trajectory, while the 4.5 is bent more. And there you are clever and put your detector, and you can see that proton. Yes?
How can the Roma or Bologna pots of Totem be there all the time?
Okay, so I would say for one thing, let's call it Roman pots, everybody, otherwise it gets difficult, since I think the Bologna people may not be around. And
I studied in Bologna.
Yeah, okay. So you make all the Bologna pots. So the thing is that there's a different detector technology being used in the boat. I think it's scintillating fibers, if I'm still correct. Craig can correct me. For the alpha, it's still like that, right? And it is silicon, hard silicon, which is used for Totem. Now, I should say that at the moment, we are actually having an issue with Totem if they really can stay at the large luminosity runs. I think at 10 to the 33, they may get cooked also. So we are actually thinking now of putting even harder and therefore more expensive silicon in them to keep that alive. But there is a difference in detector technologies. There may be also a difference between the trigger, in the sense that when you're sitting at 200 meters, which is where these devices are sitting, you really get at the edge for being in time for giving a signal to the main detector saying that, hey, I'm in time, I'm there, so you can trigger, or the data comes in time to be included in the event itself, because there is only a bit more than 2 microseconds available. And although it looks a lot with the speed of light and all the things what has to be done in there, it's just at the edge, so that's also critical.
And also, you said that these studies are interesting for cosmic
waves. Lecture number two. I'll show a few examples. But it's basically to understand the extensive air showers. These are showers where cosmic particles of an unknown energy, but very high energy, hit the atmosphere. They create a shower. The shower produces particles. And what we measure is at the surface the result of the shower. And what the cosmic ray people try to do is they try to reconstruct from that what was the sort of particle that hit. Was it a proton, or was it, say, an iron nucleus? And what was its original energy? Now, on event by event, you can't do that. But you need, and they use models, Monte Carlos, to do that. You need well-tuned information to do that backward type of thing. And what we will measure is the dynamics of when a very high energetic collision happens, how it comes into many particles. Are there many? Is there high PT? Do there only a few which share a lot of energy? And that helps to identify that back. But I'll show examples tomorrow for that. Anything else at this point? Ready for elastic scattering? So, this is the process, and the total cross-section is measuring everything. Why on Earth would we want to know that? Well, most of these interactions which we're actually going to have in the LHC are largely those where we can't calculate precisely what is happening. Perturbative QCD won't work because we don't have a high scale in the process. Typically, we get like 500 MeV type of PTs on average getting out of these particles which we produce. So it's like a peripheral type of collision, and they call it soft collisions, where you get a number of particles being produced. And that will be dominant. Now, there are interesting things you could learn about that. There are people spending their life thinking at correlations and flow of quantum numbers and this and so on. So it's interesting in itself. But in principle, if you would be interested in this kind of physics, and as there are, You would run for, like, say, a day or so and measure these events, and then you're done with, because you know, you have done so many million events, and probably you can have enough for most of the studies you want to do. That would be okay if these events would go away, but they don't go away. They're always there, and as they're going to be there, they're going to also affect the measurements for example, looking for a very subtle effect in IPT jets, maybe even in Higgs finding, supersymmetric finding, and so forth. These events often are called minimum bias events, which is actually a wrong name for these events. They're really soft events, and the minimum bias events, which is a very operational definition. Where does it come from? Minimum bias events were first defined, I think, by the UA5 experiments at CERN, because they had a trigger, and they had lots of triggers, and there was one trigger where they thought they catch most of the events without introducing a bias to it. All the other triggers, you know, they were looking for some energy in some corner or something like that, so that was a more biased trigger. So they call it minimum bias, but in fact, they still were biasing the selection of these events. They were losing some of the single diffractive, for example, components with low masses and things like that. But it was the best they could do. But since then, that has sort of creeped in the jargon of hadron physics, and they talk about minimum bias events as if they were everything with no bias. It's not quite true. What you can say is that the minimum bias events, which every experiment will take with some kind of trigger, which is very open, will be dominated by these soft events. But in minimum bias events can be also some hard events. There could also be a Z, for example, in a minimum bias event, be it very rarely. Okay, now, the cross-sections we know have a certain behavior, and if you look at as function of the center of mass of energy, so the LHC is going to be here somewhere, at first we have in the calculation of this, in this diagram here, we will have what we call first more like a region type of exchange, and a region would be any sort of QQ bar meson, which you can think of like rows, omegas, rho primes, and so forth, and that gives a typical discrete. But at low energy, one was sort of one was dominated by this this kind of behavior. While at high energy, it seems to be more a different type of trajectory, which is here, which is phenomenologically called a Pomeroy definitely, which is the sum of all allowed exchanges, which are, in fact, compatible with the quantum numbers of the vacuum. And I'll show a little bit more on the Pomeroy when we talk about diffraction. So this was the behavior. So we have some phenomenological fit based on the data as we have done so far, which is up to the Tevatron data, what to expect at the LHC. But we don't know for sure, because we don't have a real theory which tells us what is there. So we get some guess, and if you look at the plot of all cross-sections, as you may have seen before in other talks, this is the total cross-section, which is dominated by these soft events, by 99.9%, I would say. This will be the cross-sections which you're dealing with. So you see the enormous amount of order of magnitudes between that. And although these are soft and by itself innocent, easily recognizable because they are so soft, there are so many of them that they will may overlap. And at highest luminosities, it will be actually such that you may get up to 20 on average, up to 20 of these kind of events per bunch crossing at a high luminosity. In the lower luminosities, it may be little, but I heard that maybe even for the luminosity we may get this year, because it's not just the luminosity which counts, but it's particularly the charge they put in the bunches of the accelerator and how they squeeze, how the beams going into the interaction region. We may get already maybe like 5 of these minimum bias events for the highest quote-unquote luminosity runs which we'll have in the coming year. So this will be something that's going to hit us soon. And obviously, when you have this, these events, it gives you activity in the detector. The neutral energy, you really don't know where it comes from your primary collision, which you're interested in, or from these minimum bias events, which are being overlaid with it. They will confuse things in the tracking and so forth. So the better we know them, the better we understand them, the better we can arm us against that also when we look at the IPT physics. And for example, this is a very old picture by now, but this is a Higgs sitting in there. This is the Higgs event, in fact, with the 4 muons sitting in there. And this is how it could look into the CMS tracker, like that. Now you can make simple cuts to clean that up, but nevertheless you see there's a lot of occupancy going around. Okay, so the first thing to try to measure is the total cross-section. And as said, we have some data around, and even some controversial data in the Tevatron area, where there are two measurements which don't quite agree, which already tells you that this is not as simple as measurement as you may think to get the total cross-section here. This is one from CDF, this is one of another experiment, which repeated it and got about the same number or so. And this is the what if you take sort of phenomenological models of some sort and you extrapolate them through that data, you either take this lower or upper bound as your guidance, what you would find in the LHC region. So there is like a 10-20% uncertainty for sure. These are some cosmic ray data which are scaled to be here just for visualization, but they have a basically unknown normalization factor here. So there is a large variety here, and you would like to understand in how far you can actually measure that. So historically this has been done, and so the technique to go ahead is actually known for that. And you could say, well, naively just count events and say that can tell me how big the total cross-section is. Now the catch is, of course, that you must know your luminosity then to a good extent. Luminosity tells the machine how many interactions you can get per time unit of a certain type. And we think we can measure this luminosity with a precision of maybe like 5-10%, and probably worse at the start, maybe like 50% or 20%. So if you would just count events, this would be your uncertainty or your cross-section. So you want to try to do better. And you can do better by getting to sigma tot from with the so-called luminosity-independent method by using the optical tiering, which I gave in the beginning. And that was basically the only reason I introduced a little bit of rigid theory in there, where you've got two relations where the total cross-section comes in. There is one when it is just the luminosity times the cross-section gives you the number of events, which is the elastic and the inelastic ones. And there is one which relates it to the scattering amplitude or the imaginary part at t equals zero, which I had, which is this relation between the elastic scattering and the total cross-section. So this you measure from elastic scattering. You look at scattering for t equals zero, which you can't actually do. You always have some finite t, but you can extrapolate to t equals zero. And then you can pull this thing together. Luminosity disappears because here you have the square dependence, here you have linear dependence, so you just divide the two equations. And you get the luminosity as function of something you measure in the inelastic scattering, plus some rho component here, which is some ratio which you would need to measure in a special region, but we don't worry about that. It has a very, since it's squared here, it has a very small effect on the thing. Doing that, in fact, so Toden claims they can actually measure the total cross-section with 1-2% accuracy. Mind you, just event counting would give you 5-10, even 15% type of accuracy, so that's much better. The startup optics, which they want to try, maybe not as good, and therefore maybe it's up to 5% even at startup, but still it should be quite a bit better than you would do by event counting. And then once you have that, you can use that number as an absolute calibration and start measuring in the experiments, like with Lucid, the relative calibration of luminosity. But you determine sigma tot here to very good precision. Now the elastic scattering part looks as follows. You have at very, very small t, from very, very small momentum transfer here, you have a so-called Coulomb scattering region. Then you have what is called in the Pomeroy exchange part, which is the main part of the elastic scattering. And then you come into the perturbative region when t gets large enough. In between, there is an interference region, and there is some kind of structure which actually was the cause of the name of diffraction to this whole type of processes here, because it had something like a diffractive pattern with dips and bumps in there. If you want to measure that, you would have to go and measure very, very small t in the experiments for the Coulomb region. If you could do that, you could measure this rho parameter, which I said before, and that has been done actually in some experiments, but that, as I said, is only a correction, so it's not essential. The Coulomb interference region, you have to go to 10 to the minus 3 here. Totem will not be able to do that. Maybe Alpha from Atlas will be able to do that. They come more in that region here. And then, and then you have the other ones, which will be available, and they will be measured by Totem, for example, or by Alpha. And that's the technique of the Roman pots, or the whatever, let's say the Italian pots. So you have a particle coming here. These guys are sitting and waiting for the moment. And when the actually you, the beam is stable, and then these particles pass here, they will be coming closer to the beam. And typically, such a pot, if this is the displacement for the vertex, this is how the particles will go. And it just this just shows that similar particles with similar momenta will actually get at similar places in the detector. And you move away up to something like 15 sigma from the axis of the beam. And that's probably as close as you want to go for safety. Sigma here means that that's the width of the beam, and that's 15 times the width of the beam you have here. That's probably as close as you want to go. If you come closer, then the intensity gets large here, and if the beam moves a little bit, it starts burning in the detector, and that's not good. And also, if you come too close, you create too much background for the machine. They also don't like that. So there's a mutual agreement that this is something like a good number. Maybe it's 10 at the end, but something of that order. And this is a Roman pot. In fact, this is one which Totem will be using. And the measurement region where you actually measure the protons is just this one here. All the rest is mechanics to get the thing down and get that. But this sort of square or diamond which you see here is the active region. And this is silicon. It's actually sitting behind the window here, so you don't see the silicon. But that's a small entrance window. So as said, Totem is one experiment who tries to measure that. Atlas also tries to measure that. They have these alpha detectors. They have more Roman pot detectors, which I will talk about tomorrow. But now, for now, the alpha ones are important. And they will be used for low luminosity for making that measurement. And here are a few characteristics and some pictures sitting. Again, this is the active part of the detector. It's only a few square centimeters. It moves through here, and then here actually it will hang out and measure the particles coming out of the beam. And I think the result for 100 hours run at this type of accumulation is something like 2.8% precision for the cross section. And I said there are, apart from just being pragmatic and having this, there are interests in measuring these cross sections. For example, there are some models which, in the same philosophy as John, I spend only a small fraction of my talk on, which reflects my belief in them. But you can have situations where, for example, the cross sections go up to 200 microbar, when nominally the other models would give something around the 100 microbar level or so. There are some suspicious things in these models which I will not go back into. But if that were true, if this cross section would go up that much, that would be terrible news for the LHC, because then not only you get 20 overlapping events for the given luminosity, but you get 40 of them. And so better not be correct. And then there are other things where you can study what is actually happening in this T diagram here. So these are these diffractive patterns which I mentioned for this, which have structure. And this structure can actually teach us, for example, in a generic way, if there are maybe hard cores in the proton and soft cores, like this, maybe a hard core with a cloud around it, if this is the real structure of the proton. So on as a non-perturbative approach to trying to understand this type of peripheral type of collisions. So anyway, that has a project by itself. Good. So far for total cross sections and elastic, and I will start with diffraction after that, but I will allow for some questions before. Most of the diffraction I will do tomorrow for the LHC. Yes? Not for the Roman pot. For the Roman pot, the technique is actually that they are hanging belches here, and when it's safe, they move into the belches. So the beam pipe is here, and when they go down, like I try to do here, they can actually will go down and hang about 15 sigma away, which is there will be no beam pipe to cross. The only thing the particles will have to cross is some kind of entrance window, because the detectors are not hanging in the vacuum of the beam pipe. That would be forbidden. But they hang, they stick into the beam pipe, so to say. They move in mechanically whenever we think it's safe. And then there is a small of the millimeter type or so aluminum type of entrance window through which the particles will go. So they will have very little material to cross, actually. That's one of the components you want to reduce as much as possible, because otherwise you get rescattering and things like that, and it makes it more difficult. Yes? Well, you have to do that with the precision of keeping of the order of 10 micron or so, and that is possible with certain very the small engines they have to control that, because they don't move by much; they move by 2 centimeter or so, not more than that. And you can control that, but better than controlling it is that you want to cross-check that, and you need a lot of calibration data over longer terms to really cross-check that your detectors are still where you think they are, and that it is an important issue for the offline study, for the interpretation of these data. But but so far, it will be a new challenge actually for the LHC, because we have to do that to a precision as was never done before, because the small fractions, 100 micron difference, for example, makes a big difference in the interpretation of what sort of proton you're seeing. Yes. For Atlas,
why three? Like, why can't
have
only one? What's the difference?
Okay. In fact, Was it further? I think. Right. These two have, in fact, a similar type of acceptance in terms of what acceptance for the proton momentum and the T value of the proton you will have. But they will have a very different technology. And the technology of these green ones, the yellow ones, will be also including timing information. And it will be therefore usable also when you have pileup events. While these ones are basically based to run in special runs where the pileup is no issue. So that is going to be one thing. So the functionality of the detectors is going to be different. The thing is that these are ready now, so you can make that measurement now, and you want to make the total measurement now. And the other ones are more relevant for the exclusive processes, which will come in a few years. And they are, in fact, still in the R&D stage, so they are not quite ready yet. But it is so that here you could have both. These ones on the 400 meter will have a very different acceptance. And they will be needed to see objects being produced here by the size of the Higgs mass, for example, because they will produce the protons which can be caught basically only in these detectors, but not in these, not both protons in any case. So they will have a different acceptance. So they will be complementary, and I'll show a plot tomorrow of the complementarity of these two regions. Yes? You're not a student.
But you're measuring away out in the Pomeroy region, or so how well can you sort of extrapolate back to get the peak?
Relatively well, because you measure it typically till 10 to the minus 3 or a few times 10 to the minus 3 where you are. And on a logarithmic scale it looks far away when you still have to go to t equals 0. But on a linear scale, it's not so much. And in fact, the correction, the contribution from that region is only a few percent. So even in extreme ways of extrapolating that, you make a correction of the order of a fraction of a percent, 0.5% or so. And so it enters into systematics, but it's not the dominating part. So, yeah. You have a question? okay. Yes?
Productive to the combined system of all of these.
Well, some of them are not friends of the other, yeah? Like the collimator, you don't want to have in front of your Roman pots, for example, and they are not exactly at the same positions either. The where the Roman pots are is not the most ideal position for the collimators, for example. In fact, there's a collimator sitting not too far away at 100 meters or so, and one behind the Roman pots. So these things, where they go, are actually discussed in a common working group. But so far, the implementation is done individually for the most optimized sense. But be assured that there is crosstalk, because we don't want to find ourselves with a collimator in front of our Roman pot, for example, you know, when we started running. But it's not integrated as one project. Okay, so since the chair is getting hungry, I'll better say something on diffraction, which I hope he likes. So, going to diffraction now, and going to diffraction in hadronic scattering. We saw this diagram, the elastic one, and these are diffractive diagrams, which is the single dissociation, as I said before, when there is one system that can sort of, for example, dissociate, and there's the double one where there's the other one dissociating. Now, what you exchange here are colorless objects, as far as we know, because here we had the proton coming out, proton coming in here. If we look at exclusive type of interactions, like in the past was done at lower energies, you could see that these quantum numbers again add up to be for the proton, and you have the proton there. So there is really something colorless exchanged here, and if you have colorless exchange of that level, you have a large rapidity gap. And so the characteristic, the association of having diffraction and large rapidity gaps, that interplay has been very important over the last 15 years or so with the Hera and Tevatron experiments, and has become very crucial. It becomes visible when you go to higher energies, like we went for Hera or the Tevatron or even SPWRS. So this is a T-channel exchange object here with objects with the quantum numbers of the vacuum. There's no color, and that has been pointed out, or that has been coined, I would say, some in the 60s probably, to be called a Pomeron. Now, if you look in the particle data book group and you try to find this particle, you won't find it. It's actually not there. It's not actually meant to be interpreted as a real particle being exchanged here, but some blob of probably colorless glue which is being exchanged, and that is creating the effect as it has. Nevertheless, for the historical reasons, why we think diffraction gets important is that we would like to understand actually diffraction in terms of quarks, gluons, and QCD. So it's a significant part of the total cross section, like 25%, as I said. And by studying this, we believe that it's a tool to actually understand the transition between hard, perturbative, and soft confinement regions of QCD. And the region we want to study that best is in sort of a hard scattering and doing so-called hard diffractive scattering, which is the thing I will concentrate most on. And there has been a lot of progress in the last 5 to 10 years about that, the only thing is that we often refer to the Pomeron but as if it were a real particle, but it isn't. Some diehards too still believe that it could be a glue ball, which is actually could have that function, but I think we should more see it as an exchange. And here is the father of that invention at the time. Good. So, diffractive scattering, a couple of variables which we're going to need is how much energy loss does a proton loses in here so that this thing breaks up and bounces for the mass which you have in here. And typically, the momentum of the object which is going in here plus the momentum of the outgoing proton should equal to 1. So you can calculate that variable from 1 minus the momentum you measure in this proton, which you do, for example, in a Roman pot. And that gives you the relation to also the mass which can be involved in here, because that is the total system which can happen here. So typically what you will see is a blob of particles being produced in rapidity and a gap here towards the proton what you have. And there are some useful relations here given of how these variables behave. Now, what we're going to look at, and we'll do that tomorrow, is just to give an idea, when do we call something diffractive? Typically we call something diffractive if of the order of the proton momentum lost on the other side is 5% or less. And if that's 5% or less, then the maximum sort of mass we can have here by using the formula before is, rule of thumb, something like 20% of the square root of s you can put in. So that means for different accelerators which you may have, from the PS, the ISR, the Tevatron, or the LHC, these are sort of the masses maximally reachable for a diffractive system you're going to have here. So in here, in the past, you could look only for some resonances. You could look for jets in here now in with the Tevatron. And maybe at the LHC, you're going to have top production in there now, which is a new thing opening up. I'll skip that. About... There are ways of looking at these. Well, maybe I do say something. One way of detecting diffraction is that you may have a gap in here. The other way is by detecting the proton. The proton I discussed before with these detectors. What about the gap? The gap sort of analysis you can only do if you have one event in your bunch crossing in the collision. If you have multiple events, then your gap will be smeared out by the other events. You can't do that anymore. But can you still do that? Well, here is shown what happens, how many pileup events you get as function of luminosity by 10 to the 32 to 10 to the 34, and we will be operating mostly here also, where we have a few, say 10 to the 32, we have a few events per bunch crossing. Still in 22% of the interactions at 10 to the 33, there will be only one interaction happening because it's a Poissonian spread. If you go to twice that energy, twice that luminosity, it will be 4% anymore. And then higher, you can forget it, because there is, you know, always at least two interactions basically going on that. So you can do a lot of this physics already at startup without having actually these spots around. Okay. I think I'll go into the details of the physics for the gap and the hard scattering tomorrow, and I'll stop here. Yeah, 33. That's actually, I think you said that also 6 years ago. Because this is one of the three slides which I still use from then.
Okay, we have plenty of time for questions in the discussion session this evening. So could we leave it till this evening? We've got plenty of time. Because we've got to 12 o'clock. So let's just help Eric.
It's good that they're asking so many questions.
Oh, yeah.